Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Philadelphia Singers music director David Hayes. His group is hosting the Chorus America Conference, the annual gathering of choirs and choral groups from around the United States. Susan Lewis takes us to the University of Pennsylvania Museum's exhibition about generations of Pennsylvanians who kept their Lenape identity secret for two centuries. David Patrick Stearns previews the latest production from the Opera Company of Philadelphia. Baritone Nathan Gunn and tenor William Burden star in Benjamin Britten's The Rape of Lucretia. And Jason Pfeiffer delves into the history of tattoos and body art with a visit to an exhibition at the Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
This week, choral singers from all over America will converge in Philadelphia for the 32nd annual conference of Chorus America. Hosted by the Philadelphia Singers, the conference features speakers on philosophical issues such as singing and social justice, as well as small group sessions on practical matters, from fundraising and marketing to vocal care and maintenance. And of course, there'll be voices raised in song, morning sings around breakfast time, and throughout the 4 days, concerts by Philadelphia area choral groups. Earlier this week, I spoke with Philadelphia Singers music director David Hayes. Let's first of all talk about the concerts. What's it going to be, or is it going to be different, to be performing in front of a room of people who really know about this stuff?
Well, I think there's probably a little extra frisson of excitement that will pervade the atmosphere, because I don't want to say that one performs any better or less well for your regular audience than you would for an audience that might contain 400 of the kinds of ears that are very hyper attuned to what's going on. But I think there will be kind of an extra sort of little excitement level, and it's almost like going on tour in a way. I mean, you're in front of an audience that doesn't usually hear you. You want to perform at your absolute optimum best, and you want to present the organization in the best possible light, because these people are going to go back to their communities, and you want to leave them with a great impression of who you are and what you do.
The majority of the people who will be at this Chorus America conference are, like yourself, people who aren't directly involved in the professional choral industry. How is the choir business artistically? Is it getting better? Is it becoming more popular? What's the state of the nation?
I think it's growing. In fact, at this particular conference, Chorus America is going to be releasing the second choral impact study that they've done. There was the first one that was about 5 or 6 years ago, which was the first time anybody had ever done a nationwide survey to see where our chorus is kind of in the hierarchy of the arts. And what they discovered was some astonishing figures and astonishing facts. Something like 28 million people across the country participate in choral ensembles of one kind or another. Now, that's including church choirs, that's including every possible kind of chorus. But the fact is that 28 million people singing in choruses across the country, it's a pretty significant amount of people who are engaged in choral music. And a lot of those people not only make their own music in their own ensembles, but they go to hear other ensembles. So there were a lot of astonishing figures that came out of that initial study. And the new survey that is about to come out and will be released at this conference, apparently, from what I've heard, is going to show even more astonishing levels of choral activity in the country. And I think what will come out of all of this is that there is going to be growing evidence that choruses are an incredibly important part of the fabric of the arts in the United States.
This conference represents a great opportunity for the Philadelphia Singers. What does success look like at the end of this conference?
Well, I think for us, the success of the conference will be measured by, from my perspective, you know, did we give a performance that I'm really pleased with and happy with? I'm sure we're going to, but there's always that nagging thought in the back of your mind, like, well, anything can happen, you know. But they're well on track, and we have a wonderful program planned for the conference, and I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a wonderful performance. But I think beyond the chance to perform for our colleagues and to have our local colleagues perform for us, this is another opportunity that the conference avails. It is not simply our performance that is that is featured at this conference. There are several other ensembles that are performing as well, and so it'll be a nice chance to hear a larger cross-section, if you will, in a very short amount of time. It's a chance for us to kind of, as a choral community, sort of come together a bit and sort of share what we're doing. There's a lot of very interesting things that not only are we sharing with our colleagues nationally, but we're sort of sharing with each other locally and regionally. And I think that's also important that we, on a regional level and a local level, continue to find ways to work with each other and work together to create a stronger local and regional community. I think that would be really a great outcome.
David Hayes, music director of the Philadelphia Singers, will be performing Bruckner's Mass in E minor and other works on Thursday evening at Philadelphia's Kimmel Center. Other concerts in various locations around the city as part of the Chorus America Conference include the Princeton Singers on the Crossing on Wednesday evening, the New Jersey Youth Chorus Friday afternoon, Singing City and the Bucks County Choral Society on Friday evening, and the Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia with Leah Stein Dance Company on Saturday afternoon.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
According to conventional history, few, if any, Lenape Indians remained in Pennsylvania after the 18th century, most having been killed or driven west by European settlers. However, an exhibition at the University of Pennsylvania Museum tells the story of those who stayed, forming communities whose members hid their Lenape identities, yet managed to continue and pass on their traditions in secret for nearly two centuries. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to Fulfilling a Prophecy, the Past and the Present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania.
When University of Pennsylvania anthropology student Abigail Selden was putting together a one-case exhibit about what happened to the Lenape people, she met with the elders of today's Lenape Nation of Pennsylvania and asked them why there was virtually nothing about them in the literature.
Every book I've read says that you don't exist and that you're not in Pennsylvania anymore. And they said, yeah, we know. I said, but you're here. And they said, well, we've been keeping our history a secret for 200 years, so of course it's not in the books.
The Lenape's cautious willingness to share their history was a doorway, opened a crack, into another culture, a natural fit with a museum dedicated to understanding the world's cultural heritage, let alone one in its own backyard. Selden's advisor, anthropology professor Bob Prusell, curator of North America at the Penn Museum, says that while most of the cultures in the museum are presented at a point in the past,
for example, ancient Egypt, we have incredible collections here, but there's not a lot on contemporary Egypt here. So one of the things that we want to do with Native America is to show the continuities and connections between the archaeology, the history, and the contemporary communities.
So what started out as a small student project grew into a museum show covering hundreds of years. Co-curated by Selden, along with Chief Bob Red Hawk Ruth and Shelley DePaul of the Lenape Nation, it took its shape and context from a story handed down through the generations called Prophecy of the Fourth Crow, about, among other things, hiding and returning.
Long ago it was said that a fox will be loosened on the earth. Also, it was said four crows will come.
As the story goes, the first crow flew in harmony with the Creator. The second crow tried to clean the world, but he became sick and died. The third crow saw his dead brother, and he hid. The fourth crow flew the way of harmony again with the Creator. The ending comes full circle.
Caretakers, they will live together on the earth.
As told here, the first crow in the prophecy corresponds to the Lenape before the first contact with Europeans. The second crow represents the period from about 1600 until 1800, when initially peaceful coexistence with William Penn and others deteriorated in subsequent generations. This is starkly illustrated by an enlarged 1764 ad placed by one of William Penn's sons in Benjamin Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette.
John Penn is offering payment to civilians who capture Delaware or Lenape individuals or who kill them and turn in their scalps as evidence. And the payment for a male over 10 years of age was $134 and for a female $50. So there was a really clear heritage in Pennsylvania of indiscriminate violence against people of Native American heritage.
By the beginning of the 19th century, remaining Lenape had either fled or gone into hiding. And it is the next 200 years of secrecy, represented by the third crow, that is the driving force of this exhibition. Chief Bob Redhawk says his people found ways to survive.
Whether it was intermarriage, whether it was hiding who you are, you did whatever you could. If you could pass as a white or even as African-American, and this is even during segregation times, we were low men on the totem pole.
Passing as members of other ethnic groups was in some cases made easier because intermarriage was common. Selden says Lenape women, for example, married German farmers and kept connections to their land. Generations of intermarriage eventually created a population with looks as diverse as the larger culture. Children could be blonde and fair-skinned, dark with black hair, and everything in between. Outwardly, they assumed a non-Lenape identity. In the privacy of family gatherings, they continued to practice Lenape traditions and pass down stories. Even outward appearances were full of symbols, as shown in this exhibition on things as ordinary as a kitchen apron with a particular stitch along the bottom, or a wooden fence post with a subtle carving.
Poles like this one were scattered throughout farmland. This has a face on it pretty clearly, but it could just be a signpost.
And what is the face?
It represents Mising, who's the protector of the woodlands.
The importance of secrecy was drummed into the youngest of children, as evidenced by a rag doll in this show.
If you look carefully underneath her hair, which is now pulled to both sides, you can see that there's a second face. And this was a doll that was made for a little girl by her Lenape grandmother in the 1940s. And the woman told the little girl that this doll had the second face and that this represented the little girl's Lenape face and her identity, which she had to keep a secret because she could not tell anybody who she was.
Secrecy, rooted in fear, became part of the culture. But now, perhaps it is indeed the time of the fourth crow. In recent years, more people have begun to openly acknowledge their Lenape heritage, particularly as caretakers of nature. In 2002, the Lenape Nation signed the first Treaty of Brotherhood with churches and other community groups, pledging to support the Lenape cultural education programs and their work for the environment. The chief himself has traveled openly internationally, on tour with his large drum, which for now sits in a gallery at the Penn Museum, along with artifacts and photographs, evidence of children and parents, grandparents and great-grandparents.
These people were living, breathing people, and it's because of their ways of surviving that we're here today, and we're hoping that our children can come in here now and be proud.
It is their story, and it is our story. A rich texture in the national fabric, an important part of what it means to be an American, native or not.
That report was by WRTI's Susan Lewis. Fulfilling a prophecy, the past and present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania is at the University of Pennsylvania Museum through July 2010. Not since the days of Richard Tucker and Robert Merrill has there been a tenor-baritone combination like William Burden and Nathan Gunn. But while they've shared the Academy of Music stage in Opera Company Philadelphia productions of Così fan tutti and the Pearlfishers, heard here, they're currently starring in Benjamin Britten's more challenging The Rape of Lucretia at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theatre. The financial rewards aren't as good in this smaller 650-seat venue, but the acoustics are much better. Both of them are singing opera in this theatre for the first time, and during a recent lunch break and rehearsal, they explained to the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns why it's important for them to do so.
Not all opera is grand, and grand isn't necessarily great. Benjamin Britten's Rape of Lucretia, in particular, gains its near-suffocating power from portraying a smaller world closing in on its characters. This strange, entrancing piece, written in 1946, has no rousing choruses, no big orchestral interludes, no place where the message can be lost. And what really is the message? What is it in the story of an Etruscan prince raping a faithful Roman wife long before the birth of Christ that appealed to this composer? Burden and Gunn have sung this opera before separately, and though they give much thought to such questions, their role is to ask rather than answer. William Burden believes you can revisit the piece constantly and see new things in it in relation to what's happening in your own life.
We're not just talking about love and death in typical operatic
themes. They're so interwoven with so many other incredible psychological, sociological, emotional issues that we all struggle with throughout our entire lives. He really was writing pieces of theater set to music. And so you need to find the way to get the dramatic import across, and it's really not about the singing.
The plot is driven by the sexually aggressive Etruscan, but Nathan Gunn plays him not as a mere conqueror. His victim, Lucretia, is a symbol of integrity in the world and one he loves. And by destroying her, he destroys himself.
I love the libretto. I think it's remarkable writing, you know. And it is, I think, typical Britain in that he's always discussing the nature of what happens to goodness in the world and how it's corrupted by our touch.
It's sort of provocative in all the best ways that theater is, I think. Yeah. It will definitely be a piece that the audience will be forced to talk about after they leave the theater.
Philadelphia opera goers don't always have patience for pieces that are quiet and haunting. Therefore, the new generation of more dramatically believable opera singers is needed more than ever. Burden and Gunn made their careers by looking as good as they sounded in the 1997 Glimmerglass opera production of Iphigenia on Tauride. There, they were told that they wouldn't be wearing the traditional operatic robes and capes. Given that both their characters were shipwrecked, they wouldn't be wearing much at all. And if you're worried about that, they were told, hit the gym. And they did. Though they owe their careers to their voices, physical believability indeed gives them an edge.
I think the days of the 250-pound Zalame are pretty much done. No one's going to put up with it anymore, and you don't have to. And I think we've certainly broken down all of the stereotypes of the big fat opera singer because everyone realizes now that that does not have to be a part of the experience.
Yeah, but having said all that, it's still the voice. It's the first thing. You know, I think we just have a larger pool of people to choose from. It used to be all Italians. Now you've got everybody from China and Korea. And I mean, there's a lot of people.
Eastern Europe.
If you want a Cho-Cho-San to look like a Cho-Cho-San,
you can pretty much do it.
Yeah.
If he didn't cut such a dashing figure on stage, Burton might never have landed the title role in Bernstein's Candide at Paris's Châtelet Theatre in what was the production of a lifetime, a graphically hot, wildly irreverent outing that created a sensation bordering on scandal. In recordings, he enjoys a specialist niche in the French repertoire, such as in this rarely heard song by Emmanuel Chabrier. Stage directors are always contriving one reason or another to get Nathan Gunn's shirt off. That kind of glamour, plus a pliable lyric voice, has given him a side career singing in occasional concert versions of Broadway shows. In this more popular vein, he's almost like a throwback to the 1950s Howard Keel-style romantic baritone.
A fellow needs a girl to sit by his side at the end of a weary day. To sit by his side and listen to him talk and agree with the things he'll say.
What brings both of them back to Britain is the prospect of not having many more chances to sing the piece in the future. The decision was an easy one for Burden. He simply commutes from Princeton, where he lives with his wife and two children. Not so with Gunn, who has a wife, five children, and a faculty position at the University of Illinois in Champaign. But this is a gig with one distinct advantage. The musical decisions are simple. Prior to his death in 1976, Britten said over and over, "Everything you need is there on the page." Younger singers might see this as restrictive. Older ones sense profundity in Britten's incredible precision.
I find that the more I get myself out of it, you know, the better, because every time I try to inject my view of life into it, it's like putting a prism in front of the Mona Lisa, you know. It's not quite what it's supposed to be.
Burden learned that lesson emphatically while studying Mozart at Indiana University.
I was fortunate enough to study for 10 years with Mervyn Harshaw. And I was in a lesson one time, and I was singing through a Mozart aria, and I was being absolutely as artistic as I could possibly bring myself to be. And she and I had a wonderful relationship, but this particular day, she slammed her hand down on the piano and said, "How dare you think you can bring anything more artistic to this piece than Mozart already put there? Sing what's on the damn page."
That kind of exactitude is likely to be more fully appreciated in the Proman Theater because, unlike larger houses, such detail can be heard. The selection of this opera, however, might seem out of character for the Opera Company of Philadelphia, which built its audience on standard productions of standard operas in the Academy of Music. The opera company's executive director, David Devan, says Lucretia is meant to set the tone for the company's future outings at the Kimmel. Next season will be another specialist opera, Gluck's Orfeo.
We want the Perlman series to be a place of artistic journeys. I think with this particular work, I don't think it's a scary adventure. I just think it's different.
These are heartwarming words for those of us who find our appreciation of standard works like Carmen enhanced by periodic adventures into alternative aesthetics. And few communities have major stars in chamber operas. Is that because the business plan doesn't always make sense, or because nobody has really tried?
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. William Burden and Nathan Gunn star in the Opera Company of Philadelphia's production of Benjamin Britten's The Rape of Lucretia at the Kimmel Center's Parliament Theatre through Sunday, June 14th. Tattoos are pretty common today. They adorn athletes, bikers, movie stars, soccer moms, even Barbie dolls. But in the United States, this body art hasn't always been so ubiquitous. The Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia has a new exhibition that explores the tradition and development of tattooing in America. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now reports, the show provides a rare and detailed look at the role of tattoos in maritime culture.
Tattooing is not new. Using needles and ink to create permanent marks on the human skin has been practiced in cultures around the world for thousands of years. In some cultures, tattoos have long had religious significance, while others treat it more as decoration. There are more sinister chapters in history with tattooing, when permanent marks were used to identify persecuted groups, prisoners, and slaves. Tattoos have also had a special relationship with the sea, or at least those living on it. Craig Bruns conceived and researched the Independent Seaport Museum's new show, Skin and Bones, Tattoos in the Life of the American Sailor. Inspired by tattoo design samples called Flash that have long been part of the museum's collection, Bruns created the exhibit to examine the origins of tattooing in the United States. While tattoos have been around for many centuries, Bruns says American traditions of the body art began with British seafarers in the 1700s.
During the Revolutionary War and the colonial period, of course, there wasn't really an America, so British sailors had a long tradition. And for much of the early American Republic, sailors were the only individuals with tattoos.
The men picked up tattooing traditions as they visited the South Pacific Islands, Mediterranean cultures, and other parts of the world. In some ways, the indelible markings were souvenirs, but Craig Bruns says they were much more than that. Tattoos represented the unique sailor life on the sea.
They had a whole separate culture, and tattoos were the things that signified them visually from others. Tattoos were like guild symbols. Various craft guilds had their aprons or their symbols, while sailors had their tattoos.
Seafarers continue to carry on these traditions of tattooing. Skin and Bones includes Popeye the Sailor Man's tattoos and a Norman Rockwell image of a sailor getting inked, and actual sailors talk on film about the personal significance of their markings.
Basically, all the tattoos I have represent some part of me, whether my personality or anything I've been through or anything that I'm trying to become.
To be sure, not all sailors have tattoos these days, but the body art continues to hold deep meaning for many. Philadelphia native Richard Sam Benedetto has been in the Coast Guard for 18 years. His body is covered with dozens of tattoos. He's not exactly sure how many. He stopped counting at 54. According to Sam Benedetto, tattoos have long signified a rite of passage among sailors, helping to create strong relational bonds.
Only so many people can experience what 50-foot seas are like getting to it in the equator when you go through the Panama Canal, when you sail around the Horn. There's certain crossings. Each sailor goes through a rite of passage, and to now be associated with it, you know, sometimes they might tattoo an anchor, you sail in the Atlantic. swallows for 5,000 miles at sea. They will tattoo that on them. And that's where the brotherhood comes in.
In a large photograph at the Seaport Museum, visitors can get a look at San Benedetto's feet. A pig is tattooed on the left foot and a rooster on the right. San Benedetto says the animals demonstrate how superstition also plays a part in sailor tattoo traditions.
Two things I've heard at sea, these animals don't swim and they want to get you back safe. So you tattoo rooster on the right, pig on the left, and they'll get you there. The other one is they kept these animals in crates, and then when the ship sank, these crates floated free, and they were the survivors of a shipwreck. So superstitious, hey, they're on my feet. I'm still here today, and I've been through a lot.
Life on the sea is hard. Craig Bruns says historically, sailors didn't have many possessions or personal space, no place to hang a picture or decorate.
But you did have your body, and so you could carry those images with you. Images of good luck, images to identify yourself, images to remember loved ones.
Inspired by their experiences at sea, sailors started, in large part, the tattooing trade in America.
When you have the needle on there, it actually, this is what it sounds like when you're tattooing.
Edward Denny, also known as Sailor Eddie, is a Philadelphia-based tattooist. Sitting in his tattoo parlor at 2nd Street and Girard Avenue, he explains that his grandmother and grandfather started tattooing in 1933, and he began giving tattoos in their shop when he was 8 years old.
What I remember as a kid, up until when the Navy Yard closed, I remember sailors, it was a big part of our business.
And the early tattooists in the United States were usually sailors, setting up shop in port towns like Philadelphia, San Francisco, Norfolk, and Seattle. Ex-sailors and traveling carnivals helped bring tattooing traditions to Middle America, yet Sailor Eddie says the imprint of sailor culture remained.
It defined a style, and it was mandated because of the liberties and people being on leave, and they'd come into port, and you had to do a tattoo really fast because they got paid on the 1st and the 15th. You wanted to get them before their money ran out. So you had to get them on, do good work, and do it as fast as you could to get to the next guy. And that is what defined what is known as the traditional style of tattooing.
Okay. How would you describe that traditional style in terms of the aesthetics of it?
It's a bold outline with a lot of black shading and only three or four solid colors.
The basic elements of tattooing haven't changed much since Samuel O'Reilly invented the electric tattoo machine in 1891. But tattoos have become more detailed, nuanced in shading, and even abstract as new generations take on the craft. Nick Schoenberger, a Philadelphia-based tattoo scholar, says the popularity of body art has ebbed and flowed in the United States for hundreds of years, pointing to the subcultures of hip-hop, bikers, punks, gangs, and sailors. He believes the practice is rooted in the desire to be associated with other people or an idea.
Primarily, I think it's always about group identity and the individual within that group.
But Schoenberger admits that as tattoos become more socially acceptable in mainstream culture, increasingly etched on more visible body parts, body art is becoming less about group identity.
Now is the first time since maybe the early 1900s, 19-teens, where tattooing is also fashionable.
A fashion that in American culture can be credited to sailors. From colonial times until today, their tattooing customs remain unbroken, sustained by camaraderie, superstition, and memory. This ancient art form continues to grow and evolve as it reflects and projects identity on the sea, in the playing field, or at the mall.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Skin and Bones, Tattoos and the Life of the American Sailor is at the Independent Seaport Museum in Philadelphia through January. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony in C under Rosson Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.